Accession number 9146, rule number 8.
Brigadier Wedderburn Maxwell, tape 8. Did you see anything of tanks during the Third Ypres battle?
I didn't see anything of them. Of course, they were a long way to the south, down in the front of the old Somme battlefields, on nice fresh turf, good going, good tank country. But unfortunately, and they had a complete breakthrough. The Germans had no idea what was happening. They suddenly had these appalling-looking things come rushing at them. They could do nothing about them. And so they were driven right back behind the Ludendorff, what's it called, the Hindenburg line. And it looked like a great success. But most unfortunately, they were used in penny packets. In other words, it wasn't a complete overwhelming surprise. It was the first lot to see how it went. The result was that when, this is on the 25th of September, I think, when another attack went in, the Germans fought their way back. And when the second tank attack went in greater numbers, the Germans were ready for it, with guns specially earmarked to take on the tanks as they came rolling in. And that was it was a big tactical error. General Swinton, who was a very famous old man in the Royal Engineers, he was one of the main instigators of the tank itself, under Churchill's guidance and forceful drive and so on. And Swinton, he, as I say, was the tank manager, this is a tank producer, and wanted them to be employed properly, in mass, and have won a lot of breakthrough, which they could have done. And that is really all it was, just the wonderful secrecy that got them right up into the front line with the guns firing to deaden the noise of the tanks clattering up. That is all beautifully done, and the tactical thing, but strategically they were not given a chance to do a decisive breakthrough. That was in September. The Germans were by that time not in the... This is September... Well, when did we got to? 1917, isn't it? I think that's the right year. where do we go now? You've got another...
Yes. Did you actually... Were you ever in sight of Passchendaele Ridge?
Oh, yes.
Were you
I was
ever
in
that area?
Yes. That bad winter, we went back into action in the autumn and winter of 1917. And my guns were right up on the extreme left of the British forces, plumb out in the open, in appalling mud, with Passchendaele Ridge running in front, and the Germans had a complete view right into all my gun positions. But luckily, we were there in a defensive role and not in an offensive. In other words, we did not have to go shooting unless anything really serious happened. When it didn't matter then, but so long as we kept quiet, no Germans were going to bother about shooting up a little battery of 6 guns out in the mud who never repented did anything. So I was lucky there, although it was on paper it looked a very dangerous and unpleasant place to be. Actually, it wasn't too bad at all.
What could you see of Passchendaele?
You could see just a long, fairly low ridge, and you could see the guns sparkling. Some of the German guns as they fired, you could see the flashes of the guns as they fired like that all along the ridge. Mind you, there were days when there was no gun shooting, no shooting at all. I mean, none of us had enough ammunition to throw away unless there was something to shoot at. But we were there for quite a long time, and the news from the world news was getting worse and worse. Russia was out, France was pretty well out, and there was us. Alone up there. Now, if the Germans had been able to attack France and knock her out, we were finished. We couldn't possibly have carried on just the imperial forces of Britain and the Empire. There weren't enough of us. But mercifully, that didn't happen. And then we were told, when we were out behind Ypres, having a refreshment, I suppose, of a few nights' sleep and so on, We certainly were told that the Germans were massing down in the old Somme area, and that There was a very big attack being planned against us, and the British forces were redeployed to take on this new attack and dig in more defences and put up more wire right down across the Somme, way down further south. Well, we were in General Headquarters Reserve, the 8th Division, and we were put at 12 hours notice to move by train. The general came round to see us, see how we were getting on, said, "What notice you had?" I said, "We're now at 8 hours notice, sir." He said, "Well, that's a nonsense. They can't get the railway trucks ready by 10, by under 12 hours. And so that's what your notice is." But the Germans are massing in the south, and almost at once, I think it was the 28th of March, 1918, wasn't it? The 28th of March, when this cloud broke. And then we were ordered into our trains and to go down south into the new colossal German offensive. They had 50 divisions, which was a lot of men, about a million, attacking on a very wide front. And we trained down, passed down to Amiens and passed, and we were supposed to get out at a certain place called Marcel Cave, but we couldn't get there, it was being bombed from the air. We're beginning to come in now, bombing from the air. And so we had to pull up short of our destination, and the men jumped out, and the horses were jumped out of the chevaux wheat en quarante, you know, as they had on all their wagons. And we jumped the horses out onto the railway line and ran the guns and vehicles off and went up into action with our colonel this time. And the whole front was entirely fluid, and people didn't know where anybody else was and so on. And my job then again, still as captain, was ammunition and rations and stores. And I went back towards Amiens to get more ammunition, and as I was returning towards my guns, my battery, suddenly there was a cloud of dust, and there was a Canadian, well, was a man with two guns, two field guns, in full gallop back across the Maidan. And so I pulled him up as he came to the bridge where I was, asked him what the hell he thought he was doing. He said, "I'm the last goddamn battery in the world, and I'm off." And I said, "You're not the last. I've got my batteries at least 15 miles to the east of this. For God's sake, don't panic." And then he went on his way, and I went on back with my stuff up to the guns. But we had a very... I enjoyed that bit. It was lovely weather, lovely country, and only a modicum of danger, and lots of excitement. And the guns came back and back and back to another little river just south of Amiens, where Bill Duncan, I met him, he was now on the staff, very much loved there. He was writing out the orders for the next day. He was in a sort of a dope like this. He could hardly put pen to paper. He was absolutely out. He hadn't had a sleep for about 2 days. But I thought it was a terrifying way to get your orders. However, we got our orders and were sent up to near the main road and came into action. And then I was ordered to pull them back again. I don't know where my major was by now. I had orders to pull back and went back over the nearest river right up to near Villers Bretonneux, which is the Australian War Memorial today, and where we found ourselves covering the Australians and New Zealanders, which was good. And Amiens only 5 or 6 miles behind us, and if the Boche had got there, all our communications were cut, the rails would have been out. And that was when Haig issued his famous order, "Back to the wall." You know that one, don't you? Well, we were right back on one of the tributaries of the River Somme, running up northwards towards Amiens. And the French were not coming to our help. They were frightened further south, but they had some good troops still left. But we were entirely depending on ourselves. And when I say ourselves, I mean the Imperial armies. And then then, fighting just up by Villers Bretonneux, it was died down a bit, and we suddenly saw columns of French guns. And the French had at last realized it was deadly dangerous, and they were sending up masses of artillery to help us. And we stopped the Germans there. We had Haig's message, backs to the wall, and there was nothing left to do now but to fight it out. There's nowhere to go, there's nobody to help you. And it was the most inspiring message. It went right through to all ranks. And I'm sure it had a tremendous effect.
Were there fierce battles at that time? Hmm? Were the battles very fierce?
Well, the battle was still going on. This is a big German offensive in 1918. It was a terrific thing. Later on, I returned to this, why the French wouldn't come and help later on. It was very understandable. But when we'd finished that, we were then taken down south again. We went down to the lower reaches of the Somme near the sea and had a complete break while the infantry reformed and reorganized and took in recruits and trained. And there was no fighting, as far as we were concerned, for quite a bit then.
How chaotic was that period, you know, during the big German
push? Well, we didn't
push.
Know who was where. I mean, there might have been Germans in this village and the British in the one just next door to them. And you never knew. Everybody was, the Germans were doing this sort of thing to try and find weak spots so they could get round and come round behind us, like that.
And yet you said you enjoyed that part of the war.
I felt well. I was riding a good horse. The sun was shining, and instead of sitting in a trench with the horses behind you, you were moving the whole time and doing something very definite, getting the ammunition up to the guns. I got a lot of ammunition up to one lot of guns at a place called Rosière, where the battle was by way of being at its hottest. We didn't see any Germans, but suddenly the colonel had appeared, and we got the whole 18 guns in line. Or 24 guns, I think we were by then, in line, covering a valley. No sign of any infantry or anything, but the colonel sent out mounted men to watch the flanks and see no Germans coming round behind us. And suddenly, a little party arrived, the cavalry machine gunners, a man called McTeith or McNeith or something, who got a cavalry machine gun squadron with him. And we said, "What have you got here?" He said, "Well, we're very short of ammunition. We've got plenty of machine guns, but no ammunition. Well, we've got some." And we said, "Well, we want some protection." He said he couldn't give us any protection. His orders were to go back. But he said, "I'll give you as many machine guns as you want and all my ammunition. But you, and some men to handle them. But I would ask you to bring your men, my men, out on your wagons when you withdraw from here." We said, "Fair enough." And so we then suddenly found ourselves as well as a cavalry machine gun squadron tacked onto the battery, onto the brigade.
And that strengthened your position?
And that strengthened our position. But then, when we found there was no British troops anywhere near, we had to pull back. Our orders were to retire in an orderly way as far as possible, as far as the river. We were moved south with three other very tired, very hammered divisions down to the River Aisne, which was a quiet spot in the battlefield between Soissons and Reims, or Reims. And we got there, and to our pleasure, we found three English ladies in a little village called Bouvancourt. This was Mrs. Broderick, sister of Lord Middleton, her daughter Daisy, who became a great friend of mine, and her cousin, who became Gwyn Peake, who became wife of Admiral Sir somebody, Freddie Dalrymple Hamilton, after the wars. I don't know if he's alive now or not. But we found these ladies there, and we told them what had been happening up north. And they said, "Well, you know, the French have always held out that is not their main attack. Well, one said, "Oh God, what's that mean? That could be like." I said, "No, but they didn't trust it, and they felt that the real thing was going to come down by Soissons or Reims straight for Paris, and the Marne."
So they were holding themselves for that, were they?
What?
Were they holding themselves for that? Do you think then?
Well, the French.
The French.
The French said, "This is where the real danger is." But when things up north got so deadly serious, they decided the priorities were different, and they had to come to our aid, which they did, and successfully. But down there, in the south, in the Champagne country, which was absolutely gorgeous, and I used to take Daisy out for rides and that sort of thing, and we had guns, my battery, or rather the battery of which I was captain, was on the River Aisne, well to the north, and the canal Aisne. I took the ladies up in a wagon one evening to have dinner at the battery, my son's battery, my brother's battery. We did that and drove back in the lovely moonlight night to our little village of Bouvancourt.
What were these ladies doing there?
They were doing cantinière. They were cantining with the French army, and the French army had handed over that front to our four tired divisions that I've already mentioned. And they were more or less waiting to move on with the French, but they stayed there for a bit when they found British troops moving in, and it was all very pleasant for me. And then one day they said, then I said that after that night party, I said to Daisy, "Tomorrow we'll bring you a horse and we'll go ride up and have another look at the country around here. It's so lovely." But that fell through, and they went to dine with the French army headquarters that night, the local French army, a big affair, I mean, the general, one of the top men in the French army. And they turned up at our wagon line, our horse lines. They turned up about 8 o'clock at night instead of 11 or 12. I said, "What's happened?" They said, "Well, the whole place is in an absolute flap. They've got the news just very late that there's a colossal attack coming tomorrow morning at 1 o'clock. And the whole French army headquarters is in an uproar and sorting things out in a flap." And so I rang up my battery, my major, and they had their warning that there was an enormous attack waiting for us. And so next morning, at 1 o'clock in the morning, it started. And it was just peaceful like this, and then suddenly a crash. And over about 20, 25 miles of front, there were 50 German divisions from Russia, all deployed in the Ardennes, which, as I say, is all thick-wooded country, and would hide any number of men. And they debouched from there, and they set upon our people. They simply overran everything. You couldn't stop them, however many you killed. The captain of the battery I was with, no senior sergeant, he was killed fighting with a machine gun in his hand, and the battery was overrun, and a large number killed. They and the Devonshire Regiment, with this battery on the same area, they fought literally to the last man. And the French Army headquarters afterwards gave them a citation, the Croix de Guerre to the unit, the Devonshire Croix de Guerre Regiment, and this 5th Battery, Royal Field Artillery, is also a Croix de Guerre battery. I rang up my brigade headquarters to ask what orders there were. I was at the horse lines, I say, as a captain's job, and I'd already sent off as soon as the battle started. As soon as I heard the battle was coming, I sent off down to the workshops for the only guns that were available for shooting, and they were brought up. All our guns up in action were overrun by the Germans. There wasn't one left. And so I tried to get orders as to what I was to do, but nobody had any orders to give me at all. So I had these 3 guns, I think it was, and I took about 60 or 70 gunners mounted singly on a horse and out of their teams. I destroyed the wagons and things I didn't want. And with my 2 guns and unlimited ammunition, I started my own private little retreat, Not where anything was. I got right up onto the hills behind a place called Vale, V-E-S-L-E, and I was above there this first night of the retreat. It was a glorious moonlight night. The air was warm, the country was beautiful to look at. The fighting had died down during the night, and once more the Brodericks had given me a couple of bottles of champagne, the French had given them. But by the time I'd spent the day on the horse, in the hot sunshine with the bottle in each of my saddle wallets, when I took the cork out, most of it went with the cork. But we had that. Then I had some most wonderful shooting, because looking out across the valleys, you could see the German hordes, literally hordes, pouring from one bit of cover to another, from one wood to another. And I was within comfortable range, and I had the most tremendous shooting into these masses in the woods where they were all congregating, you know, on round about my front, till suddenly a German battery opened on me. They'd come up following their own infantry, and they found their infantry being beaten up by me, and they saw my gun flashes, and so in came their shellfire. Well, I pulled my men away from the guns, ordered them out to a flank, and then after a bit the Germans stopped shooting at us, and so I made them crawl down, get up right up to the guns, and then at my signal the drivers galloped up with the teams, hooked in with the men lying on the ground, onto the top of the gun on the gun wagon, and away we went and got clear of it, and went back to the next staging post. And then I suddenly got orders. Somebody on some staff found me with my little army, and ordered me to go to a certain place well to the west, I think towards Chateau Thierry, to take on German tanks with my 2 or 3 18-pounders. Well, we went on. We found that the German tanks were actually French armored cars. So I said, well, goodbye to you, chum. I'm going back down to the Marne. I've done enough of this all by myself with no orders from anybody, and nothing left to shoot at or with. And so I went down to the Marne, and there I crossed the river, a place called Dormont, I think it was, it doesn't matter, and went up onto the hill, the Grand Patin, Petit Morin, and the Grand Morin, great big boggy things on top of the hills, and I've never heard or seen such mosquitoes. My beloved horse, chestnut horse, with a very thin coat, he was just as if he got measles the next morning. He was absolutely little swellings where these filthy mosquitoes had got him. After that, run tumbled to it and put a paraffin, gave him a rubber with a paraffin that kept them off. But that was really almost the end of my war, the end of my fighting war. And the major of my battery was captured, of course, with everybody else, up with the guns. I hadn't been able to get anywhere near it. My brother had gone up ahead of me with his teams to bring back his guns, but all he did was to find suddenly a German machine gun pop onto the road a few hundred yards in front of him and open fire. So he whipped down and said, "Sergeant Major, come on, I'm off." And they whipped back to get to their own teams, being old soldiers, although only very young. They knew not to have your stuff all with you. They went on to see if everything was all right. So we got back and picked up his teams and went back down south of the Marne, and then we were trained up north to the Upper Somme area by, I can't remember the name of the places now, but we went into a rest there, and that was where we had this flu. And it went everywhere. And if you moved, if you took any strenuous exercise, you were pretty certain to break your heart down. The German army had it, we had it, everybody had it.
Did that stop action? Did you find things had to quieten down when this flu broke out? Did it stop activity?
Yes, I think it did, but we were out behind the line at the time, so I'm not able to say it firsthand what the troops actually facing each other were doing. It was there that my great friend Roland Palmer, who was one of the Harvey Nichols nephews and a subaltern in my in what was now my battery. Roland and I went into Abbeville and spent the day there having a good square meal and looking around. And at the tea or supper, whatever it was, there was very attractive little ATS girls. They were in there. Were they ATS or WAAC? I always forget which was which war. Anyhow, these WACs or ATS said they were very cheerful little things. They said, we've got a concert on tomorrow. And Roland and I said, well, we'll come to that. He said, no, you can't. It's not for officers. It's only for other ranks. I said, well, don't you be too certain. And they laughed, and we went home. And I said to Roland, we'll go to this party. And Roland said, of course you will. And so next day, I sent for my sergeant major, most delightful man, top disciplinarian, but a wonderful friend as well. I said, sergeant major, I want your paybook, your hat, and your jacket. I want them tomorrow at 2 o'clock, and if I get into trouble in Abbeville, you'll be for the high jump. I haven't got his paybook. The sergeant major looked at me in the eye and he laughed and handed over his paybook and everything for identity. And I said, come on, Roland, we'll now go in and go to this concert. And we went in our battery trap, which is drawn by one old Dobbin of a horse. And when we got to the outskirts of Abbeville, I said to the driver, who was a miner from Airdrie in Scotland and my servant, I said, now, Hal, we're getting out now. You keep on down the middle of the road with the trap, and if Captain Palmer and I make a dash for it, as soon as we're in the trap, you hit that horse like it's never been hit before and disappear. Well, we walked down the street, and a colonel in the Army Service Corps, or the doctors, came coming towards us, and Roland was all flustered and forgot to salute. And I heard a bellow, Sergeant, yes, Sergeant Major, what are you? And then Roland looked round and saw what had happened, and very upset about it, and he apologised to the senior officer, and on we went. And we went on to this hut where the concert was being held, and our two little girls were there, and all the others, and everybody knew what was happening, because they looked at us, and they fairly tittered, and we had damn good fun at the concert, and then it was time we went back to our batteries up the road, and as we went out of the hut, down the duckboard, do you know what a duckboard was? As we went down the duckboard, there was an old sweat sitting in the ditch there beside it, picking his teeth and grousing away, and he looked up and he saw us, and he looked up and saw the girl, he said, cool, Sergeant Majors and Quarter Blokes, nothing less. That was one of our naughtinesses, very harmless, it was great fun, and of course we'd have been in terrible trouble if we'd been caught. So I went back to the battery, of course, and gave the sergeant major his paybook and his hat and his bandolier or whatever he wore, I can't remember. And that was that.